This is episode number 27 of the Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. This show is hosted by Jeffrey Zeldman and Dan Benjamin. That's me. And this episode is brought to you by the .tv domain name. With your own .tv domain name, you can amplify and extend your own video conversation. Let the world know you mean business about video. If your site has a play button, like this one does, it's made for a .tv domain name. You can secure yours today before they are all gone at getseenon.tv/bigweb. We're also sponsored, as usual, by MailChimp. MailChimp has been working with some of the best designers in the world to create beautiful email templates that anyone can use. Whether you're a designer or you know nothing about design, doesn't matter. Just plug in your content and that's it. You can check out the new templates at MailChimp.com/designer-templates. And here today, as always, with Jeffrey Zeldman. How are you, sir?
I'm great, Dan. How are you?
Doing very well. Glad to be here today on Veterans Day.
Yeah, I don't know if you can hear. My studio is right on Fifth Avenue. And I don't know if you can hear in the background, but the parade's still going on. It's the Veterans Day parade. And yeah, I just wanted to take a minute before we start the show to think about and honor and thank and hope that someday that kind of sacrifice won't be needed. Although people have been saying that for 10,000 years, they hope that someday, you know, we'll beat our swords into plowshares, but I don't see that day coming soon. Just thank them for their service. Today is Armistice Day, right? This was the last casualty of World War I. And that's why this is Veterans Day in the U.S. But I just think it would be nice to take a moment before we go back to complaining about iPhones and talking about celebrities to just think of these people whose courage protects us.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeffrey. And amen to that.
Speaking of protecting us,
are you going to be okay or do you need...
No, it's just a tough segue.
Is it? How do you do that? How do you transition to Andy Clark? You just say, we have Andy Clark.
And speaking of courageous, wonderful human beings, here is Andy Clark, designer. I've called him a triple threat before. He's a designer, coder, author, and looks fantastic in a suit. He's a great presenter. It's kind of sickening the way the ladies respond on Twitter when Andy's talking. It's funny because like pretty much anyone else is talking. They're like, people are just, I don't really agree or yeah, I heard it. When Andy gets up there, he could really talk about anything, I think. Talk about phone books or something. They're just like, it's Don Draper. Oh my. But of course the dapper thing has to do with your new book. So let's start with that. I mean, your book is based on a theme of dapper, daring detectives. Am I correct?
Yeah. It's all branding, isn't it, really? You just make this stuff up as you go along.
So tell us about the book.
Hard-boiled web design, which came out, I think we're about 3 weeks in now. And it's doing very well, thank you. It's kind of a sequel or a follow-up to the first one that I wrote a few years ago, the Transcending CSS book. So it takes a lot of those themes and gets really kind of angry and ranty in places and just generally tries to shake things up, which is what the whole book's about.
Which is unlike you, really, because I see you as kind of a placid fellow who goes along with the crowd and hates to stir things up. But I'm not wrong about that.
I'm a fairly down to earth rig. There's nothing more that I like than a cup of tea and my mug and putting my slippers on of an evening. You know, I don't like to go out and beat up dames. But I just think sometimes, every now and again, I think that it's useful as an industry that we shake things up a little bit. And
absolutely.
It's not always the right thing to do, and it's not always the easiest thing to do. But every now and again, whether people agree with it or disagree with it, it's worth opening up a discussion about the way that we work and what it is that we're actually providing when we're getting paid to make websites.
Now, I really want to get into that discussion, and because I know you you turn some best practices on their heads and look at them from a different point of view. And I'm going to really want to talk about that. But just before we do, can we talk for a moment about the delivery system for the book and how it's being delivered? I mean, because it's a sequel to, in a way, it's a follow-up to a book that you, but the original book, right, the original CSS book that you wrote was kind of a large, heavy trade paperback filled with artwork. And this is primarily an EPUB, primarily a digital book, correct?
Not quite, no. I mean, the last one, the Transcending CSS book that I did with New Writers, that was pushing, it was following on. Do you remember that book that Molly Holschlag and Dave Shea did, The Zen of Sure. CSS Design? Well, in the publisher's eyes, it was supposed to kind of follow on from that, which was, you know, full of pictures and trying to appeal to designers because obviously designers like pretty pictures. This one, we've paid, I would say, if you were kind of to rate it on a scale of 1 to 10, we've probably spent, it probably is 10 times the amount of detail that's gone into the design of the book. I mean, I worked with Mark Bolton and Nick Bolton and the guys down at Five Simple Steps, and we spent weeks working on design for the pages. So it's actually more visual than the last book. And the visuals mean something in this particular case. A lot of people criticize the first book for being kind of overly pretty. This one, every image means something.
They do that to me too.
Well, it's true. Such a handsome chap. So no, we're doing it. And one of the things that I wanted to do was I wanted to make a beautiful object because, you know, code books can be a little dry in places. And I wanted to make something which was a really, really fabulous object. I've watched, obviously, with the economy the way that it is, I've watched publishers, I think anyway, going down and down and down in terms of production quality on books. Right. And we wanted to do something which was a beautiful object. And the original idea was that we were only ever going to print a certain number. That was going to be it. But we are now doing, we're doing a limited edition that comes with a poster thing. But it is going to be a physical book. And the physical book ships, I think, the week of the 29th of November. And it's big. It's like, it's 400 pages and 1.3 kilos in weight, I think. So it's a great big fat heavy thing. And obviously we had to do digital versions as well. So
which are out there now.
Yeah, the PDF people could download from on day one. They could pre-order the paperback on day one, and that ships in a couple weeks. And then there'll be an EPUB at some point towards the end of the year. I think Mark was telling me that it takes 8 or 9 weeks to get a really good handmade EPUB. So I don't know what your experience is, because I know you've done book apart stuff on EPUB.
Sure.
But that's what he tells me. So we have to wait till the end of the year for the EPUB version. But
let's talk about just in the digital version, if you don't mind, because it's interesting. We started, when we do a book apart, we start with an EPUB, which is basically the most accessible version of the text with the least design control, right? Mm-hmm. We say, here's the text, and we make sure that there are pictures, and our new book's going to have video as well. But basically, it's you abandon a lot of design control, and you let it, because it's more like a web page, and it's more like a very simple web page. And then we do a PDF at the end. The PDF looks just like the printed book, but obviously it's less fluid and flexible in your reading device. And I know you've gone exactly the opposite way. So you guys came out first with the PDF, which looks fantastic. It really looked, you know, except for the fact that you're not touching paper and, you know, it doesn't have that 5 kilo weight or whatever. When you said kilos, I had a whole flashback, but that's another story. It doesn't have all that weight of a book, but it definitely has the beauty of a design book, and that's awesome. But if I want to read it on my iPhone, it's difficult. If I want to read it on a small device, it's more difficult. So I'm glad you're coming out with an EPUB, but you obviously made the decision that the layout was so important to the content that you had to lead with PDF. Was that the thinking?
Yeah, I mean, there was a number of issues. One was the timing. We knew that it was going to take longer to get the EPUB out because of the complexities of getting it done. And we didn't want to, you know, be bringing it out the week before Christmas. We wanted to ship as quickly as possible. So there was that reason. And yeah, I mean, the attention to detail that the guys have put into the actual layout design, we wanted to get out there first because I hope that, you know, people will find that worthwhile and they'll see it. I'm actually a little bit nervous about seeing the EPUB version. I don't think I'm going to want to put it on my iPad. I like the PDF.
No, I get that. I get that. I think, you know, it remind in a way we're kind of with publishing, with digital publishing, we're back where we were in the web in like 1995 or maybe in 1998, where actually 1998 is a really great year because you could have a great deal of control, but no semantics and no accessibility back then, or you could have very little visual control, but good semantics and good findability. You know, you could go Google way, or you could make like a Clement mock website that was all tables and all images of text, and it looked fantastic, but you couldn't find the content. And we're sort of, that seems to be the, with EPUB, I mean, with digital publishing, that seems to be, those seem to be the two dimensions or the two sides of the coin. We either have fantastic layouts that are absolutely faithful to the book, or we have really accessible HTML content.
And give people the choice. You know, it's great for them to be able to, you know, use any format on any device that they want. And they'll get a different experience, obviously. And they might not get what I had in my head when I conceived the design of the book. But that's okay. People pay their money and they take the choice.
You kind of want both. I mean, I want, for your book, I want the actual page layout on my device, and I also want to be able to read it anywhere and even the smallest screen. And so I think having both formats is nice for where we are technologically. I think it's a nice compromise. And the actual book itself, does it have smell strips to it? You said it has a poster. So you're doing a limited edition with a poster, and then you're going to keep reprinting it, or are you going to stick to your original scarcity model?
No, we'll print as many as we can sell. But we just wanted to create a little bit of exclusivity around the launch of the book. So Kevin Cornell agreed for us to print the cover artwork as a poster.
Wow.
And the first 2,500 people that buy the paperback or buy the bundle with the PDF get the poster, which is going to be really nice.
Wow.
So that was a little bit of something extra because I think, you know, publishing tends to, I don't know whether it's just my impression, but it does seem to be kind of cutting corners or reducing kind of added value. And we just wanted to put a little bit back and make it into something that people would really get excited about.
Sure. Opening. Well, I think publishers, I mean, obviously we're in a recession, so a very profound recession. And even though technically we're out of it, we're still really in it. And then they also have Amazon, right? Amazon's squeezing them to death. A traditional publisher, you know, they retail the book. They sell the book as cheaply as they possibly can. And then Amazon takes more than half of that. So some they've got to find margins somehow, right? So they don't want to keep laying people off. So what do they do? They might have to go with a cheaper paper or something. But small publications have the option to make a more expensive book. And
I learned a huge amount about the publishing business in the run up to doing this one. You know, I didn't rush and sign the first contract that I was offered, and thought about it long and hard. And for an author to spend the time, because you know how long it takes to do these things. I mean, it's months of commitment, and you can't, I don't know about you, but I can't do it part-time. I can't do a day's work for a client and then sit down for 2 or 3, 4 hours in an evening and write. It just doesn't work for me. So to be able to commit to that amount of time, you know, we've all got kids to put to university and stuff. So you have to earn a decent amount of money to get back, you know, for that time. And when you see things like, you know, really deep discounting on Amazon, that you know is, you know, that you know that the publisher is paying for, and therefore the author is paying for, it's a very interesting situation. And I think more and more people are going to go for smaller publishing houses like yours when they can reach their audience. And that's what it's about to me. It's about being able to reach the audience, not necessarily selling 20,000 copies, which is, you know, the big publishing house model. You know, selling 5,000 copies or 10,000 copies is enough if you can, you know, if you're reaching your audience. And that's where I think the difference is between where we were, let's say, 4 or 5 years ago when I wrote that first book.
Well, also, it's I've always felt taking publishing out of it, just going back to web publishing for a minute, it's really important to have the right readers. People used to compete with how many page views they get, and that's great. And if you have a lot of page views, that's wonderful. But, you know, if you're writing about CSS and you have 1,000 readers a day, but those readers include Tim Berners-Lee and Hokum Lee and Bert Bose and Andy Clark and Eric Meyer.
Hokum Lee doesn't read what I write, not anymore.
Oh, did you affect? Well, okay, we're not going to go there. But my point is just, you know, with the web, it's a really about reaching the right people. And I think because of the shakeup in publishing, traditional publishing has that opportunity as well to, or whatever we're doing. When I say traditional, I just mean we're making books. Mm. Right? But the books that we're making, we can print fewer numbers, we can offer electronic versions, and we can, and because we don't have the same amount of overhead, and because we're kind of avoiding Amazon, I love when you say that. My daughter says Amazon now, and she's not English, but I taught her to say it your way because I think it sounds so much more elegant. Anyway, when we can avoid, you know, the big retail markets that crush publishing, then I think we do have the opportunity to narrowcast and succeed. And given that we've just talked about that a little too much, I'd like to actually talk about your book. What's the content of the book, and what do you mean by hard-boiled, and let's go for it.
So you've seen the talk that I've done this year, which is kind of the book evolved, the content of the book evolved during the course of this year while I was doing that talk for an event apart. But really, I've been fascinated by detective stories for years. I mean, not kind of Agatha Christie stuff, but really kind of, you know, the old film noir detective stuff, 1930s, 40s, 50s, that kind of thing, where it was all about the hero. And it was all about the hero making his own rules to crack the case or catch the killer or whatever it would be. And that was something which I thought could be useful in terms of a reference to web design, because those heroes don't compromise. They're still on the side of right, but they don't compromise. So, and I firmly believe that, you know, as web designers, we can do what we need to do, but not necessarily have to compromise in the way that we've often had to compromise in the past. So that's the tenet of the book, really. It's about encouraging people to reevaluate how they think about web design or how they show off web design to clients, or co-workers, or however it is, to be able then to use all the new cool technology stuff, HTML5, CSS3, all of that stuff that we all like to talk about.
Are you saying that you can't use HTML5 and CSS3 unless you're a maverick who breaks all the rules and is willing to rethink how you present content?
No, I think everybody can. And I don't think we always necessarily need to talk about it or explain it to the people that we work with or whatever. We don't need to be a maverick at all. Sometimes we might need to be a little bit more, a little bit braver perhaps within an organization or with a client to get some of this stuff through, and to think about different ways of explaining those technology choices. But no, we don't. Everybody can do this stuff. That's the whole the whole approach with Hardboiled is making a plan to use all this cool stuff by rethinking the way that we do web design.
Talk specifically about, if you would, about that the kind of graceful degradation, I guess, revisited that you're proposing.
Yeah, you said that I declared war on Dan Cederholm, I think, when Dan was on the show a few weeks ago. It's not really about that. Generally speaking, what we have these two terms that we hold as gospel in terms of best practice for web design: progressive enhancement and graceful degradation. And whenever you read something on a blog or you look at a new tutorial and something different is explained, people then will always go back to those two terms as if those things are, you know, written on tablets of stone. And my problem with both of those terms, first of all, they were written back in 2003, which, you know, is a very long time ago. But the way that we've applied progressive enhancement has always been from the lowest common denominator browser up. So you start off commonly by designing something that works great in IE6, and then start to layer on. Dan Cederholm calls them kind of visual treats for people that use modern browsers. You start layering on extra CSS stuff for more modern or more capable browsers. My problem with that is that I think there's only so far that you can reach up if you don't keep the new technologies right at the core of the design. You will always end up just with, you know, rounded corners and shadows and perhaps the occasional gradient. So I think that my kind of reevaluation of progressive enhancement really is to think about designing for the best browsers first and then working downwards through browsers that have different capabilities. And people say...
Best browsers or best browser capabilities?
Best browser capabilities. It's not about the brand. It's not about the rendering engine. It's about the capability of browser. We never do browser sniffing. It's all about capabilities. And people have said, well, you know, isn't that just graceful degradation? If you're starting at the top and then working down, isn't that just the opposite of progressive enhancement? Isn't that just graceful degradation? But the problem with graceful degradation is that we're not in control often. If one browser supports rounded corners and another browser doesn't, we're leaving that design difference in the hands of the browser. We're not taking control of it. And the whole hard-boiled approach really is to take ownership of those differences and say, let's design something different. You know, sometimes the difference will be small. Sometimes it will be completely different. There'll be a completely different design based on the capabilities of a browser. But let's actually take control of those differences and design around them rather than either hacking around them or putting the control in the hands of the browser. You know,
in other words, a different, potentially a very different but equally compelling visual experience for someone who's using an older browser. So they don't just get the same design, but without the rounded corners, without the gradients, without the drop shadows. They get a different design that's effective in their environment and works for them. Kind of an extension of your an idea you proposed a year or two ago, where you were saying that you were tired of designing branded sites for IE6 or making sites work in IE6. So you came out with some simple style sheets that look great. Basically said, here, so you can serve something like this to your IE6 users. And they, you know, they won't see the same design as everyone else. They'll see a design for their browser's capabilities, and that's just fine. It's kind of an extension of that idea, correct?
It's an extension of that. And it goes back, you know, years to when I did a colored version of my blog, and then a black and white version of the same, of a different design, a two-tone design, black and white thing for IE6, which was, you know, a joke at the time, but... It kind of brings all of these things together. in combination with some of the stuff that Ethan Marcotte's been talking about in terms of, you know, responsive designs, lots of common threads all coming together. Because the main thing, I think, the main point to stress is that I think it's about time that we realized that this one-size-fits-all approach that we've had to web design for a long time, since day one, perhaps, isn't relevant and can't be relevant anymore. When you're only having to deal with the difference between IE and Firefox, then, you know, you could still grumble about but deal with the differences. Today, it's completely different. And I think most web designers and developers actually get that. They really do understand that we should be doing something which is tailored to the capabilities of browsers and possibly, not always, but and possibly devices.
I think mobile has done a lot of heavy lifting for us in terms of selling web standards, selling flexible design, selling responsive design, selling the idea that experiences can be different depending on the device, which was always the web standards idea, which we've been kind of preaching forever. But now that you've got smartphones and semi-smartphones and you've got netbooks and iPads and you've got gigantic screen monitors, everybody's recognizing that there's no way you're going to make a design that works that's beautiful and fantastic in a high res, super wide, giant monitor, and also provides, is bandwidth friendly for a small handheld 3G device, right? And you know, that the experience can't be the same, that users don't expect it to be the same, that users are way ahead of us now, and they get that. When they look at Flickr on a phone, it's going to be different. When they look at Flickr on an iPad, it might be different from their browser, even though the iPad has a browser. So I think mobile and the explosion of standards-based platforms, standards-based devices has sold this for us. Don't you agree?
No, I do agree. And, you know, a lot of the arguments that I used to have with clients, I don't have arguments with clients, discussions with clients about stuff I do have arguments with clients. Those things have changed a lot over the last few years because people don't expect that a site is going to look the same in Safari on an iPad or on an iPhone or an Android device as it does, you know, in IE 5 or 6 or 7 or whatever on a PC. That their knowledge is helping us to do new and cool stuff, which is what I really hope we're going to do.
I've often heard you make the point, which not many other people make, which I love, about the fact that, you know, we open a site in 17 browsers, but nobody else does. And nobody but us and our clients is going, I think there's a pixel different in IE 6.1 than in IE 6.2. You know, we're being anal obsessive about nonsense like that, but users just open whatever they've got and interact with the website and don't think or care about that stuff.
The bigger question, I think, is, as a designer anyway, the bigger question is how do we design this stuff now? It used to be that it was okay to do a Photoshop comp, mock something up in Photoshop or Fireworks. You know, I used to do 3, 4, 5, 6 different template mockups in Photoshop for different pages of a site and show it to the client. They would make corrections or observations or whatever. You would get to a certain point where they'd say, yep, that's fine, that's how I want it. And then you would go off and literally photocopy that design in HTML and CSS. Now, I think that the game has changed, and we as a industry need to figure out new ways that we actually design and present those designs to clients, and what is it that the client is signing off, and what does browser testing mean anymore? And I don't have answers to any of that.
Well, you do have practices. How do you present designs to clients now? Is it mostly in a browser?
Yeah, I never show clients, my own clients anyway, I never show them a Photoshop comp anymore. Let's be clear. This isn't an argument about designing in a browser as opposed to designing in Photoshop. It doesn't matter how you design. You can scribble things on the back of a cigarette packet. But I will always spend a little extra time, and it doesn't take too long, a little extra time mocking up two or three templates in HTML and CSS. And it doesn't necessarily have to be production-ready code either. And that's what I'll show the client. And I rarely have discussions about browsers. I'll design the best thing, because I design on a Mac, so I'm going to make the best thing that looks great in Safari. And if the client happens to be using Firefox or Chrome or IE9 or whatever browser they use, what they see is what they see. And you know, if they don't see rounded corners in IE8 and they still sign off the design, then that's a bonus. You know, I will always show a working web page and never a Photoshop comp, because I think that sets false expectations, because people will expect, if you do a design in Photoshop and it's got rounded corners and drop shadows, the client is going to imagine or going to expect that that design is going to get transferred to every single browser that he might ever encounter. And that's where you get the, you know, I've just looked at it in IE6 and I don't get those rounded corner conversations. It sets false expectations, and it also ties us into this old-fashioned idea, I think, that the same design can look the same or appear the same on different browsers and platforms. So I only ever show clients code now. I never show them a comp.
So how much time then, Andy, do you spend educating the client about this kind of thing? Or are you lucky enough to have clients that just get it from day one?
No, I think a lot of clients have, you know, they have good and bad experiences with web designers, and every new project is an opportunity to take the client on a journey with you. And I will always say, what I'm going to show you is, first of all, our evolving HTML and CSS templates. The final design won't be there from day one, of course, because, you know, we might be waiting for content, or we've got discussions to be having about, you know, the usual stuff, UI, etc. But they accept the process. I will document the process, and I'll put that in the contract that they sign, and nobody complains. In fact, they really like it. They feel more engaged with it when they can move things around in a browser.
Sure. Sure. Mike Montero said recently that websites aren't, you know, pictures. He said it better than that. I'm not remembering exactly how he said it, but it was beautiful. He doesn't show Photoshop comps for that reason, from Mule Design.
So at what point, and this is one of the questions coming out of the chat room, at what point do you draw a line with some of this new technology? I mean, there, you know, right now you talk about, you know, corner radius. That's really cool. That's nice. You talk about gradient effects. You talk about little fade in and fade out things, and that's fine. But at what point do you say enough is enough, or do you? Are you constantly trying to evolve things?
I think it's about being able to use the right tools for the job. My friend Simon Collison is famous for piling things into a design and then taking them out. If you look at Collie.com, some of the earlier iterations of that site had rotations and other CSS3 kind of trickery, which Simon took out because it wasn't appropriate to the design. It was bells and whistles. So I think it's all about context, and we shouldn't be piling these things in just because we can. But on the other side of the coin, if we need to use something which is experimental, then yeah, it's fine to do it. And there's no reason technically why we shouldn't be using anything that we need to do to accomplish the job. Technically, we can do it. What's holding us back a lot of the time is the way that we think.
Your designs tend not to look like other people's. And I mean that in a really nice way, because it's hard to do, to be original. A lot of people now design what Jason Santa Maria calls parfait websites on the homepage, where there's sort of like layers, right? Like there's the top layer of content, and then there's a middle layer below that, like you know, CR activities or whatever, and then there's blog content below that. So there's these strips of content. A lot of people do that. A lot of people have discovered that the grid and are using it. And you don't do that. Well, there's a parfait, actually. So you, Dan is showing a parfait design of yours, so never mind. But typically, your stuff doesn't look like a newspaper metaphor. It doesn't look like a magazine metaphor. It doesn't look like other websites. You don't do the white background, two-column, floated image, and you're done thing that so many other people do. You really do seem to enjoy making sites that feel more like experiences. Almost like a flash person. Almost like a flash person, only not. You know, use different
I don't know. I mean, the stuff that I do for myself, I think, is different to the client work that I get to do, which is, isn't that always the way?
But the stuff you do, for instance, I saw you do a newspaper site for a South American newspaper, I believe.
That was a while back. Yeah, that was for I think it was Costa Rican at the time. Yeah.
And did you know you hovered over images and you interacted almost like it was before the iPad, but you interacted with the content in an iPad-like way. You hovered over a photo, which would then come to the fore, and then you could get more detail and get that story. And that's not a typical newspaper site. A typical newspaper site is column, 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 photo, big photo, smaller photo, you know, classic editorial stuff. And I don't know whether you just don't work with IAs and that's why you're so creative, or that sounds like I'm against IAs. And I don't mean it that way, but I mean, what I mean is that you don't think about those, what do you call typical best practices. You don't default to typical best practices at all, or you just love being, do you start in sketchbooks? What do you do? How do you get your ideas?
Well, I start in sketchbooks. I think that the key thing is that I don't start off with a design in mind. I will work from the content out. So I'm always thinking about the content. And I'm kind of my own IA. Everything that I talk about has to be kind of tempered with the fact that I work on my own most of the time. Like some kind of, I don't know, selfish little boy gets his own way all the time.
Freelancer.
That's how we did. That's what we're called now.
The professional word is freelancer. Yeah.
Okay. So I kind of work from the content out, and I'm my own IA. I can't imagine working in a situation where I would have to do what I'm told. It would horrify me. So I work from the content out, and I think about the content and the context before I start thinking about any kind of visual stuff at all, apart from just pure layout and probably typography. So my stuff starts from layout and typography. And then I kind of layer design stuff over the top until I think until I start scraping it off again. And that's my general approach to things.
Cool. We're heading toward the end of our broadcast, and I was wondering, Dan, are there any more chat room questions that we for Andy or?
Yeah, there are quite a few in here, and they've been having an excellent discussion in here while we've been talking. But one of them is, this is by someone I wish I could pronounce their name. You know, people pick unique names here in the chat room, but I think this one is Food X. I'm guessing. Who knows? But this person asks, does moving away from the one-size-fits-all approach not increase the designer or developer workload? In other words, does this change the very dynamic of the way that you work and you're expected to do quite a bit more?
Yes, of course it does. And what a fantastic opportunity that is from a creative point of view and from a business point of view. I relish those opportunities. And I think it's really exciting.
But there are a lot of people out there, I'm sure, who are already feeling overwhelmed by the technology and overworked by their clients just to make ends meet and doesn't some of the things that you're suggesting mean, you know, that their limited time is going to be stretched even more thin?
Well, you know, you pick your battles, don't you? And none of this stuff is it's not a recipe book. Everything depends on your own clients, your own working environment, your own context. I'm not telling anybody how they should work, because, you know, I work in a way that matters to me and that works for me. But I think that they are tremendous opportunities.
I also would like to say, I think people need to raise their rates. People don't like hearing this, but one reason a lot of listeners are stretched thin by their clients and barely making ends meet is because they're not charging enough for their services. And I have lots of friends like this, and they're really talented and they work really hard, and they're not quite making ends meet because they're not charging enough. I don't mean overcharge, and I don't mean carry on like a lord, but
Dan, do we get clients watching this show, or was it just web designers?
No, I think we do get a lot of clients watching this show, actually. Mm-hmm. So they should be preparing themselves that all of the freelancers out there are about to bump things up a little bit, right?
But if there are clients out there, they can go make a cup of tea or something. But what I did for web designers, listen to this. What I did a few years ago was I was in the same boat where I was thinking, I'm only earning as much as the hours that I can stay awake. That's the freelancer trap. And I picked a random Friday out of every month. Would never be the same Friday. And on that Friday, every estimate that I did, every quotation that I did, every little job that I did, I would double the rate. Just on that day. And I would say, instead of saying it was going to be $4,000, I'd say it would be $8,000. And I never lost a job. And I kept doing it and kept doing it until I reached a point where actually, you know, it was too much. It was too much, and that was my rate. And, you know, I'm very open about this. My rate is £800 a day. And I think that's a competitive rate because of what I do. I know other people charge more and some people charge less. But, yeah, do it. Try that as an experiment. You know, just people often, and the web designers need to kind of understand this sometimes, with clients, money is never the issue. They've got all sorts of other things, but the actual amount of money is rarely the issue. So the difference between £8,000 and £10,000 for a client is nothing. They don't think about that. Unless they're trying to take that money out of the designer. So, yeah, Jeffrey's absolutely right. We need to value our skills and our knowledge and our expertise much, much more. And I've said this a few times. Clients don't pay you to show up. They don't pay you for the hours that you work. They pay you for the 5, 10, 15 years of knowledge and experience that you've put up in here. And we should be better paid, I think, for what we do.
They pay you to make them look awesome, to make them be awesome, to take where the things, there are all the things that they're great at, and then there are the things they don't know how to do. You do know how to do them, and they're paying you for that, like I would pay a tailor, right?
Do you remember that Pulp Fiction quote, Jeffrey, where you know they've blown the guy's head off in the back of the car, they park up, and Mr. Wolf comes? Do you remember the Mr. Wolf character? And John Travolta is giving the guy some grief, and Mr. Wolf says, "Gentlemen, I'm here to help. If my help's not required, good luck." And that's, you know, sometimes you have to do that with clients as well.
And
then you'll find better clients.
All true.
Well, guys, we probably need to wrap it up. Andy, thank you so much for being here today. And if people want to learn more about what you're doing and what's up, where should they go? We'll definitely have all of the links that you mentioned in the show notes so people can go there. But if they're just listening right now, what's the best way to keep up with you?
Best way of keeping up with me is on Twitter at Malarkey, and stuffandnonsense.co.uk is my domain. So everything kind of comes off that. The book stuff and the workshop stuff and everything else that I do is all coming off that.
Great. Well, thank you so much, sir, for being here today. Jeffrey, thanks so much, as always, for the great questions. Thanks to our veterans out there today, and thanks to you for tuning in. If you enjoyed this show, please stop by 5by5.tv and check out the other shows that we do. You can rate the show on iTunes to help new people find out about it. Thanks to our sponsors, GetSeenOn.tv and MailChimp.com. And this is Dan Benjamin for The Big Web Show. We'll see y'all again next week. Have a good one.